Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to another episode of the Total Disclosure Podcast, and the fifth episode on Jeffrey Epstein. Today is the last episode we will focus on him, because on the next one we will dissect the Black Book, and I will probably be able to throw in Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel, so we can finish this saga, either with one last episode or two, just to discuss those two main procurers and the Black Book. We will be talking first about Little St. James, the most famous of the two islands. It's off the coast of St. Thomas and belongs to Subdistrict East End, just like Great St. Thomas. It was owned by Epstein from 1998 until 2019, until the day he died. And it's 78 acres. It has been dubbed by the locals as the Island of Sin. It's also known as Pedophile Island, Orgy Island. Ever since Epstein owned the island, nothing good really happened in there. According to public records, the island was once worth $3 million and was owned by a woman who died in a chalet in Switzerland. In 1997, Little St. James was owned by venture capitalist Ark Cumming and was for sale for $10.5 million. In April 1998, a company called LSJ LLC purchased the island for $7.95 million. So it seems Epstein got a bargain of almost $2 million, a little bit over $2 million. And documents also show that he was the only member of LSJ LLC, of course, which are initials for Little St. James, I presume. In 2019, the island was valued at $63,874,000. The island was Epstein's primary residence. He called the island Little St. Jeff, and the main house on the island was renovated by Edward Tuttle, a designer. That's one more link in a chain of links in between people that is connected, because Tuttle was the designer of the Aman Resorts as well. Aman Resorts, property of the Russian billionaire Vladislav Doronin. And if you know anything about Vladislav, is that he used to be the full-time boyfriend of Naomi Campbell, who is on Epstein's Black Book. So there's a possibility Vladislav and Jeffrey were business partners at some point in some ventures, but that's something we will discuss once we do an episode on Naomi Campbell. It is alleged that in 2008 Epstein's estate on Little St. James had 70 people in their staff. According to a former staffer, Epstein insisted on complete secrecy from his employees. Everyone that he deemed to be talking with somebody, he would fire immediately. The island's primary compound was arranged in a Danish-style layout, with individual bedroom suites in individual buildings surrounding a courtyard, including a pair of large cockatoo statues lording over the island's gardens. The lush, secluded paradise of the eastern coast of the U.S. Virgin Islands remains well maintained despite Epstein's incarceration and passing. I mean, before the FBI raided the island 2 weeks ago, there were workers still seen at Little St. James. I'm not sure if they're still there. Either way, since Epstein's gone, presumably murdered, I guess the island will be sold to somebody else, or who knows, maybe the United States government will claim it as their property and use it for some military base, and history will repeat itself, right? They'll probably do an MK Ultra laboratory in Little St. James, the way they're behaving. And I don't know, I'm frustrated with this case, because just today the victims got to speak in court, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. Before Epstein was charged with unlawful sexual activity with minors, Stephen Hawking visited the island with a group of particle physicists, cosmologists, and theorists, including three Nobel laureates and experts on gravity, dark matter, and string theory. All had been invited to attend a conference funded by Epstein. A March 2006 photograph on Little St. James shows Hawking, David Gross, and Lisa Randall at a barbecue during the conference. Other visitors have included Gerard Hooft, Frank Walczak, Lawrence Cross, and Martin Novak. So the Little Science Club not only visited Epstein on New Mexico, New York, and Palm Beach, they also went to the island. It was declared by Virginia Roberts Gouffre that she saw Bill Clinton in the island in 2002. Of course, he denies ever being there. There's tons of logs and trips in which he appears more than 27 times, to be exact. I'll be reviewing that on next episode. As a fun fact, David Copperfield proposed to Claudia Schiffer on Little St. James 3 months after meeting her in 1993. This was before the island was owned by Epstein. But curiously enough, Copperfield would be known as a sex offender as well, with some credible women denouncing him. And to make matters worse, it seems that Copperfield and Epstein were buddies. So we will also expand on that on next episode. On a hill on the southwest point of Little St. James Island, there is a temple painted with blue and white stripes and topped with a golden dome. The golden dome now is basically was torn out. Some people said that it was because of a storm, a hurricane, but truth is, it was torn down by somebody. There was not a hurricane during the period that the dome actually dropped from the ceiling of the strange temple. The entrance of the temple was flanked by two statues, painted in gold, and one of them appears to be the trident-wielding Poseidon, the Greek god of the sea, while the two others look like birds perched on the corners of the roof. It is surrounded by a line of palm trees and a terrace with a labyrinth motif. Finally, the exterior seems to incorporate an optical illusion to create the impression that the exterior windows and door are set within carved flanks. It's styled like what you might see on a castle, with what appears to be a reinforcing lock bar across the face. But what makes the temple peculiar is that if you wanted to keep people out, the bar would be placed inside the building. Turns out the locking bar appears to be placed on the outside. So, you know, doesn't look good for old Jeffrey Epstein. It seems it's intended to keep victims in. And on top of that, it has sound dampening walls, which is much more suspicious, of course. The temple appears to have been built between 2009 and 2013, which was after Epstein got a sweetheart deal that resulted in 13 months in a county jail in Florida. There's hundreds of pictures of the location of around the temple and of every corner of the island. If you have seen the pictures, you'll notice that there is what it seems to be an underground entrance just around the hill, around the temple. For what motive? We don't know. My theory is that the kidnapped children, the youngest children, the ones Jeffrey probably didn't want the staff to see and other people, were trafficked into the island, probably underwater. We know for sure that Epstein had a submarine because it was confirmed by the New York Post when they told the story of Stephen Hawking's visiting the island. That was the very first time he was able to get inside a submarine because Epstein obliged him. So there was an underwater entrance to the island for sure. I know a lot of people don't believe in Q and the information they release, but unfortunately for those people, we gotta talk about them for a little bit, because they have been right about everything related to Epstein. They have released information since 2015, since Gawker released the Black Book. There has been a lot of drops by Q regarding Pedophile Island, and so they released a drop 1 or 2 weeks ago about Disney Cruise Line being involved with Little St. James and selecting the little island as a snorkeling spot. I wonder how many children got lost or drowned by accident, quote, you know. According to the MagicalKingdoms.com, Disney Cruise Line offered Captain Nautica's snorkeling expedition. Children as young as 8 years old could attend the 3.5-hour outings offered by the cruise line to what was locally known as Pedophile Island. According to the website, food and drinks were provided, along with snorkeling equipment and instructions. Snorkeling locations were entered from the boat. Guests were encouraged to bring sunscreen, sunglasses, additional clothing, hats, cameras, and backpacks. Now, what if I told you Disney's Magical Kingdom's cruise made a stop at the island for snorkeling? And you know, some people, the trolls trying to deflect, or I don't know why people are still trying to deny what's going on here, are saying that Disney actually took people to the cove, to Christmas Cove, I mean. But the problem is that Christmas Cove is located in Great St. James, and the advertisement for Disney Cruise Line specified Little St. James, and Little St. James wasn't known as a snorkeling location, especially because after Epstein purchased it, he used to actually send his security after people snorkeling or fishing around the island. He didn't like people snooping around for obvious reasons. So you tell me what Disney Cruise Line is doing at Epstein's Island, taking children of 8 years old and above. Kind of strange. And there's this other story about the boat that used to sail around the St. Thomas area selling pizza. And I was reading the article, and it starts written in a weird way. Let me read it to you textually. The article was written in 2015, so this was just before Epstein's Black Book got released. These people seem to have French last names, so I hope I pronounce them well. Tara Bois used to be a teacher. Sasha Bois was a programmer at Standard & Poor's. Now they run the best-rated restaurant in St. Thomas on a boat. Sometimes you just need pizza. It is a truth so universally acknowledged that entire corporations are dedicated to delivering it directly to your face. And those moments when you require it and it's not ready available are very sad indeed. It can lead to rash decisions. For instance, eating a piece out of the trash at 2 a.m. that you foolishly thrown away hours earlier. I don't know who wrote this, but that's fucking weird. I've never done that. First of all, you don't throw pizza. I mean, if it's leftovers, you just save it in the microwave or the fridge. Even cold pizza is good pizza sometimes, especially when hungover. And so I find this wording strange. A few years ago, Tara and Sasha Bois had such a moment. They were anchored in their favorite bay near St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. After years of living in the islands, this had become their favorite place to watch the sunset. Everything was perfect, but one thing was missing: pizza. At the time, the couple was working on guest charter boats, sailing out to sea for weeks at a time. Sasha as the captain and Tara as the chef. They had just returned home and were too tired to cook or take a dinghy to shore to track down food. So they spent the night eating microwave popcorn and fantasizing about how great it would be if there were a pizzeria nearby on the water. So The idea was born to build a pizzeria on a boat. And despite the fact that they hadn't heard of it being done before, and neither of them knew how to cook a pizza. When pizza calls you, you must answer, quote. And so this startup was 32 when this article was written. There's pictures of her. She seems like a normal person. She's actually a pre-girl. And there's no pictures of... there's pictures of the guy as well, but I think only pictures back when he was young in MIT, or when he used to work as a tech. MIT graduate, Standard & Poor's, as a computer programmer for 5 years. That was his profession before becoming a captain and pizza entrepreneur. Sasha is a bit of a pizza snuff, quote, being from Manhattan. Who else is from Manhattan? Jeffrey Epstein. So I don't know if these people are linked to Epstein. I only know that the boat is described to be anchored off the east end of St. Thomas in Christmas Cove, next to Great St. James Island. And the article even mentions Jeffrey Epstein and Little St. James. And it doesn't say he's a pedophile or a criminal. It says he's a billionaire financier. So it seems the article was... Could have been promoting Epstein's business with these people, with the pizza people. It's really disturbing to think about, but there's no evidence, so it has to remain a theory. Unfortunately, the links are there. The woman is from Manhattan, and the man describes himself as a mathematics lover. He loves math. I think the pizzeria is called Pizza Pie, and they use the pizza with the pie sign. So, whatever. You know, it's kind of strange. Then we have the testimony of the IT contractor for Jeffrey Epstein, because Jeffrey wanted total coverage for the island. So he actually looked for the best person to do the job. This person lasted 5 years with Jeffrey Epstein and says that today he regrets taking the job and the money. The name of the guy, the contractor, is Steve Scully, and he declared to ABC News that there were photos of topless women everywhere in the island. He started working for Epstein in 1999, and he says he's now a 69-year-old father of three girls. And he describes pictures of naked girls everywhere in Epstein's office, in his bedroom, in the temple. Scully told ABC News that he was the chief owner and operator of a telecommunications business on the island of St. Thomas when he was contracted by Epstein to set up communications network on Little St. James. He estimates that he visited the island more than 100 times. He says the memories remain vivid, and that he was the most intense person he ever met. Scully also said that Epstein wanted coverage in a secluded cove that the financier referred to as the Grotto. It seems that Epstein had a private villa and a private grotto, like the one in the Playboy Mansion, perhaps. But instead of playmates over 18, he had children of 14 and below. Pretty cringy, pretty cringy. He said that at some point he recalled Epstein wanting to change the name of the island from Little St. James to Little St. Jeff. And, you know, he describes his feelings of guilt because he knew things weren't right. He started seeing these girls just playing around, driving bicycles, playing in the pools, topless. They were always topless. And, you know, a little bit too late, but, you know, reviewed invoices provided by Scully each bill to Littleton James showed that he did about $400,000 worth of business with Epstein. He says that now regrets it. But, you know, easy to talk when the guy is in prison already, right? And you gotta wonder, who stored Jeffrey Epstein's money? We know that the Deutsche Bank admitted that Epstein had been a client of them since 2013 at least. But apparently it was way before that. When they released a statement to the press, they made a bunch of stupid excuses like their technology systems did not help, that they thought they had closed all of Epstein's accounts years ago, but just this year they discovered like he had three accounts there that they didn't notice. Quote, I don't buy that. These people were laundering money for him. And you know, Epstein also had money apparently and confirmed in Switzerland, in the back of Luxembourg, and the Grand Cayman Islands as well. So this guy had millions of dollars dispersed everywhere, just in case someone went Noriega on him. Like Noriega stole a large sum of money from Pablo Escobar. I believe it was in the early 90s or the late 80s. He was then taken out by the CIA. And so Epstein was arrested, taken into federal custody on Saturday afternoon. That was on July 6th. And he was arrested at the Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, where he had just returned in his private jet after a few weeks in Paris. He had a home in Paris. And apparently the French police are starting to investigate some claims of women in France that were also abused by this sick puppy. He was transferred to Manhattan Correctional Center to await his arraignment in federal court, and then he appeared in federal court on Monday, not before his police raiding his Manhattan home early Saturday evening. They actually broke the door of his Upper East Side townhouse. And you can see pictures they have taken, updated pictures. That door is fucked up. So, yeah, they carved it open. They found lots of pictures of underage females. In a locked safe, they found compact discs with handwritten labels with descriptions as young and names of girls, multiple girls. Miscellaneous nudes, number one. Girl pics nude, also found in the safe, were $70,000 in cash, 48 diamonds, and a fraudulent Austrian passport, which expired in 1987. It had Epstein's photo but another name. The passport had numerous entrance and exit stamps, including entrance stamps to countries like France, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Saudi Arabia. This during the 80s. The passport showed the place of residence, Saudi Arabia. Epstein attorneys excused this irregularity by saying he was advised to acquire this passport to protect himself from terrorists that might try to kidnap him because he was an affluent member of the Jewish faith, quote. Of course, he's gonna try and cover himself with being a vulnerable Jewish citizen. Mimi Rocha emphasized that her former office would offer no special treatment to Epstein, nor offer him any cooperation agreements for implicating other powerful men unless he provided some very valuable and verifiable information in exchange. And so that was her hope back then when Epstein was first detained. It's for sure that Epstein has pictures and videos of some of his friends with minors. According to the pictures shown by Rachel Chandler on her Instagram, there used to be a whole fleet of like 20 cameras just in Little St. James. And some of those cameras showed large groups of young children. You could see that those kids were at least under 15, and they seemed to be naked. So I don't know if that ever will come out in the mainstream, and people, how will people handle it, because they seem to be avoiding it. They have not spoken about Rachel Chandler. Nobody in the mainstream media has mentioned that name. And at some point, they're going to have to admit those connections. But where is Rachel Chandler? That will be something I would like to find out. And I will. So on July 8, prosecutors with the Public Corruption Unit of the Southern District of New York charged Epstein with sex trafficking and conspiracy to traffic minors for sex. The grand jury indictment alleged that dozens of underage girls were brought into Epstein's mansions for sexual encounters. He denied the charges. So the indictment only included crimes committed in New York and Florida. Didn't include the islands or New Mexico. This is when we discover well, more victims start coming out. Obviously, they felt safer to come out and finally denounce this monster. This is the first time we hear about Jennifer Arouse, and she gave an interview on July 10th with NBC's Today. And in the interview, she claimed that Epstein raped her when she was 15 years old in 2002. She is currently 32 years old. She had dreams of becoming a Broadway actress. She said that the woman that recruited her, that we now know is Ghislaine Maxwell, said that Epstein could open doors and help her career. That was a huge part of how they convinced her to give massages to Epstein and ultimately sleep with him. It was rape, but she was groomed into it. And the grooming took more than a year. These people took their time, sometimes. I mean, the victims that they kidnapped and brought to the island were already slaves, so. But these girls, he was hunting for them. He was preying on them and grooming them. They took advantage that Arao's father had died from AIDS a few years earlier. So she was a girl that was vulnerable, lacked a paternal figure at home, probably was looking for an older man to fill that void. Not for any relationship, of course, but simply some man to guide her. And that's what Epstein faked to be with her, to, you know, win her trust. And Ghislaine was also helping on that, because she used to promise Jennifer that Epstein was going to help her, that he was going to donate money to foundations battling AIDS. And, you know, that Epstein was an all-around great guy. That was Ghislaine Maxwell's pitch. So Jennifer started visiting this guy when she was just 14. At first, he was very nice and told her he had heard a lot about her. She was served wine while being a minor, and he knew her age damn well. He didn't care. Jennifer stated that she used to go to Epstein's house at least twice a week, and after each visit she received $300. Eventually the visits began to include massages. She wasn't completely comfortable with the massage sessions, but she was afraid Jeffrey would get angry. By then she was already groomed, and he was already pressuring her with the money, with the promises of helping her with the career. So after a year of frequenting Epstein, in 2002, when she was 15, Epstein asked her to take off her underwear and get on top of him. She said she didn't want to, so he forced her. And, you know, she told him to stop. He never did. And Jennifer was disgusted about what happened, but as a groomed girl, as a confused girl, she didn't actually feel that it was rape, you know. She knew something was wrong, but, you know, you can only guess what these girls feel. And so she came out, and her story, I invite you to look at the links at the description. I'm gonna post a link of her interview in there. She's a great witness. The way she explains what happened is very vivid and very credible. So on August 14, Jennifer filed a lawsuit against Jeffrey Epstein's estate, his longtime associate Ghislaine Maxwell, and three unnamed female household staff members described as a recruiter, a secretary, and a maid. According to the complaint, Arouse alleges that Maxwell and the other staff conspire with each other to make possible and otherwise facilitate the sexual abuse and rape of the plaintiff. And, you know, you gotta wonder, and this is the stuff that pissed me off. Why is Ghislaine Maxwell still free? If this woman is already saying that she was recruited and groomed by Ghislaine Maxwell, and there's a lawsuit, why is Ghislaine walking free? Is there a deal that the authorities have not told us? Did she make a deal to get Epstein arrested or something like that? I mean, it's pretty unnerving. And then you have the New York Post publishing these fake stories about Ghislaine, that she's in an In-N-Out burger. Very crafty Photoshop, but it was fake. And well, we will discuss about Ghislaine in the next one of the next two episodes. I haven't decided how they're gonna go or how are they gonna be written. I'll probably do that tomorrow. And so Epstein was arrested, and on July 18, Epstein's lawyers urged the court to allow Epstein to post bail. He offered to post up to $600 million as a bond, including $100 million that his brother Mark Epstein loaned him, so he could leave jail and submit to house arrest in his New York City mansion. He also offered to ground his planes and some other singularities. The judge, Richard Berman, denied the request on July 18, saying Epstein posed a danger to the public and a serious flight risk to avoid prosecution. And he was right to do so. This is when we begin hearing stories about the roommate, Jeffrey Epstein's roommate. So entering the story, we have Nicholas Tartaglione, who was last in the news on July 3rd, before Epstein was arrested, when it was reported that prison guards had confiscated a cell phone from him. The ex-cop denied the phone was his and said that a fellow inmate had tossed to him during a search. In 2018, Tartaglione was assaulted in custody and needed surgery on a broken eye socket. He was assaulted by another inmate who put his locker lock inside a sock and hit his head with it. So this Tartaglione guy was a former police officer that went bad. On April 11, 2016, Martin Luna, Miguel Luna, Urbano Santiago, and Hector Gutierrez went missing after last being seen entering a bar owned by Tartaglione's brother. The bar, called Liquid Lounge, in Chester, New York, was the site of Martin Luna's murder, prosecutors say. Authorities allege that the three other men were taken to Otisville, New York, where they were shot dead. The killings of the four men are being described as gangland style. They reported that the killings were motivated over a 5-kilo cocaine deal that went bad. A neighbor told the Daily News that in the lead-up to the discovery of the dead bodies on the property in Otisville, it smelled of death. The bodies were not discovered until 8 months after the shooting. In fact, Attorney General William Barr declared back in March that prosecutors will be seeking the death penalty over the crime. Police said that Tartaglione was aided by another former New York City officer named Joseph Biggs, 57 years old. The pair allegedly drove the bodies to Tartaglione's farm about 30 minutes away and buried them in a wooded area. So we start hearing stories about the roommate, and we see pictures, and we see that the guy is roided to the gills. I mean, the guy looks like he weighs like 300 pounds, and he's some kind of professional wrestler or something like that, NFL player. or I don't know. So then we have this, the alleged first attempt, the first suicide attempt that Jeffrey Epstein suffered on July 23rd. And you know, some people had been saying wrongfully that there was a power outage in New York on that same day. No, the outage was on the 13th, 10 days before. So I really wanted to clarify that, because you know, it was really suspicious if the outage was on the same day as first suicide attempt, quote. But still, you know, this is where the case begins to really get complicated, and a lot of this information begins to come out, conflicting versions and such. Because in here, Tartaglioni actually declares that he saved Epstein's life, and that they actually had a good relationship, that they were bonding over the harsh conditions in the prison, and that they had developed a friendship, quote. The two men were roommates at the same special housing unit, which is home to 99 inmates who pose a security risk or have violated disciplinary rules. Tartaglioni's attorney told the Daily Mail that his client really got along with Jeffrey Epstein, and the conditions inside the correctional center were horrible. Barquette said that the MCC was a really bad place because the lights are on all the time and the frosted glass means no direct sun gets in. The only time inmates spend outside is the rare occasions they are allowed on the exercise yard on the roof, but that has a cage on top. So they are kept for days in their cells because the guards are too lazy to let them out. The place was supposed to be infested with insects and rodents, and there is black mold in the shower. Most of the cells have leaks, so there is a standing water in many of them. The guards refuse to wash the bed linen, so inmates have the same sheets for far too long. The food is barely edible, and the beds are covered in dust. The medical care is non-existent. It's a small thing, but even the clocks in the attorney visiting room don't have batteries, so they're broken. The rodent infestation extends to the prison commissary, where the inmates can buy food and snacks, and the cells themselves. A week ago, Nick woke up and realized he'd accidentally smothered a rat in his sleep. It's disgusting. So this was their version, that's how they bonded over the terrible conditions in the prison, which is a possibility. But as far as, you know, I don't know, because the guy is a former cop. The guy is a killer. This Epstein guy is a white-collar douchebag with a, you know, smirk, and he's a pedophile. People don't like pedophiles. That's a fact. So you're gonna really put Jeffrey Epstein next to this guy who killed four people, and it's gonna be sentenced to die. He doesn't give a fuck. Not very smart, right? So either way you wanna cut it, the people that handled this business ever since Epstein entered the correctional, they dropped the ball. They took the wrong decisions. And you know, it ended with Epstein dying. Before dying, Epstein supposedly signed his last will and testament on August 8, 2 days before passing. The signing of the will was witnessed by two attorneys that knew him. And this is very strange. That why weren't the same attorneys that were representing him on the pending indictment against him in this instance? Why the switch? The will named two long-time employees, and this is confusing as well, because I've heard two versions, well, three versions. First, that all the estate was left to Mark Epstein, that's the brother. Then that it was left to Ghislaine Maxwell, and then that it was left to the two of them, you know, maybe in a 50-50 situation. But that doesn't seem to be clear, at least not for me. If you know, please let me know. He did leave all his assets to a trust, so that means his properties, his vehicles, his planes. So I guess that those are the assets that are on the line that the victims are expecting to cash in on, and they have all the right to do so after so much suffering and so much time. I mean, give it all to the girls, sell it, lump it all together, sell it, and you know, give them all the money. That's my take. I mean, it's not gonna heal them back to where they were before Epstein destroyed their lives, but it's a start. And since Epstein is dead, that's the best they can hope for, unfortunately. And so, on August 10, Epstein was found unresponsive in his cell at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan, New York. A person who had been assigned to share a cell with Epstein, and for reasons that investigators are questioning, the roommate that they placed next to Epstein after Tartaglione was transferred, because apparently Tartaglione was transferred after the first attempt. There's no clearance whether Tartaglione attacked Epstein or not, or he actually stopped him from killing himself, or, but there were conflicting versions there as well, because Epstein's lawyers claimed that Epstein told them that it was Tartaglione who attacked him. Then you have versions in the press insinuating that Epstein faked his suicide attempt to get a transfer because he wasn't happy at that jail, which is certainly a possibility. Then you have the weird chance that he indeed tried to kill himself, but I don't think that. I don't think that's what happened. I don't buy it. Epstein is a narcissist, and I believe he thought that he would get the money to get free of this situation, and he was perhaps expecting for his mega group friends, Lex Wexner and those guys that finance his very start in his blackmail career, to bail him out. That never happened. I think that people wanted him to die, to just die and get buried with the secrets of all these criminals and pedophiles. And so this is weird, because the guy is placed on suicide watch right after the failed attempt. On August 8th, he signs his will. Now, there's pictures that leaked of those signatures, and they seem to be fabricated. They don't seem to be legit. Somebody else signed for him. That's what it appears to be. So you gotta wonder who else is involved in this, because the authorities are blaming, I mean, they subpoenaed 20 employees of the correctional. So, you know, they're gonna blame the little guys, and nothing is gonna come up out of it. No big conspiracy is gonna be solved. No big fish is gonna be jailed. I mean, it's not looking good so far, especially since I'm sure the intelligence service and the FBI know where Ghislaine Maxwell is, and yet she's still free. So they took Epstein out of a suicide watch on August 9th, just to die the very next day. So it's very strange. And according to the Associated Press as well, the guards were also spread thin, with one of them being on his fifth straight day of overtime. On August 16, Barbara Sampson, the New York City medical examiner, ruled Epstein's death a suicide by hanging. According to Epstein's defense counsel, the medical examiner only saw 9 minutes of footage from one security camera to help her arrive at her conclusion. Epstein's estate independent pathologist, Michael Baden, who was at the examination, was unable to discuss the result, since as of August 16, he was bound by a gag order from the medical examiner's office and Epstein's estate. So this is very strange. Epstein's estate, who is administering Epstein's estate after he died? Mark Epstein or Ghislaine Maxwell? Who doesn't want for people to know that he was murdered? For Michael Baden to disclose what he saw? Ghislaine Maxwell? The government? Everybody? Because it turns out he suffered up to 3 fractures in his neck. including the hyoid bone near the Adam's apple, that can occur in hanging and strangulation, but it's way more prevalent in strangulation. And you know, we're just talking about one fracture. In this case, three fractures, is almost impossible for that to be a suicide. And you know, there's this person that the medical examiner, this lady Barbara Sampson, watched 9 minutes of video, but then the correctional tell us that the video recordings from the unit Epstein was housing were later found to be corrupted. So what happened here? Is the medical examiner lying? She didn't see a tape? Or did the tapes get destroyed magically after she saw them? This is flat out blatant corruption. And then we get a report from the authorities in New York complaining that the staff at the MCC are not cooperating with the Justice Department's investigation. According to staffing records, 20 of the 21 guard posts at the facility were filled the day before he died, which completely buries the version that the staff was spread too thin and overworked, leading to lapses. So that was a lie. Epstein's lawyers say they're not buying the official coroner's report regarded as suicide. They say they plan to launch their own independent and complete investigation into the reported death. A lawyer representing Nicolas Arteglione said his client was cleared of any wrongdoing in the reported first suicide attempt that nearly claimed Epstein's life. At a judge's request, the MCC's warden said an internal investigation was conducted, but he cannot divulge any information. Quote, then now we get an update on the will and testament that Epstein allegedly left everything he owned to a trust run by a group of attorneys. Epstein claimed that his estate was worth $578 million, which is nearly $20 million more than he told a judge last month during a bond hearing. So maybe he got some extra funds from selling diamonds or who knows what. But lawyers, really, he left the money to lawyers? I'd like to know who is in that little select group. Then you have the sick birthday gift. Quote, unsealed court documents now allege Epstein once had three 12-year-old girls flown in from France for him to abuse as a sick birthday present from a longtime friend and frequent visitor to Little St. James Island, modeling talent scout Jean-Luc Brunel. There's a Queen's connection as well. They published photos taken from Queen Elizabeth II royal state at Sandringham, where he took part in a pheasant shoot with Prince Andrew. Ghislaine Maxwell was also photographed taking part in the hunt, which offered the opportunity to rub elbows with the world's most powerful people. There's also a bow of loyalty. After Epstein was released from his sweetheart jail deal in Florida, Prince Andrew had vowed to remain loyal to the disgraced former financier. This despite the fact that a number of advisors were warning the eighth in line to the British crown to distance himself from the convicted pedophile. Of course, Andrew has released some statements full of bullshit, saying that he didn't know what Epstein was doing, and that he regrets his poor judgment, but he insists he committed no crime. So there's that. So these are basically the latest updates on the official version of the authorities on what happened and what they're trying to investigate on the aftermath of Epstein's murder. I also want to talk about the bodyguard that came out to talk, well, barely, because he was way more open to talk three years ago, off the record, of course, on an interview that was never published, but now it has. The bodyguard, a Russian that had a professional mixed martial arts record of 4 wins, 1 loss, and 2 draws, 2 wins by knockout and 2 wins by submission, His name is Igor Houdini Zinoviev, who served as Epstein's bodyguard and sometimes driver as the convicted pedophile crisscrossed the country to his various homes. The bodyguard is convinced that somebody helped Epstein kill himself. Of course, that's his English is not great, so you can take that as in somebody hand him a rope or somebody killed him. Zinoviev declined to elaborate on how Epstein allegedly carried out his hanging death in federal prison, saying that, you know, that's going a little too deep. He was shy on his interview. Zinoviev was born in 1967. He competed in the Extreme Fighting Organization, holding the middleweight title until their demise. Then he moved to the UFC, in the UFC beginnings, and I was doing some research on him, and it seems he was well regarded in the fighting community. Someone graciously said of him that he was one of the first Europeans to be able to beat the Brazilian fighters that were dominating during the middle 90s. He was born in St. Petersburg, Russia. As a kid, he had problems with health due to meningitis. He was unable to walk until the age of 4. To overcome this handicap, he started to train, swim. He became skilled enough that he entered a Russian sports academy. There he trained in boxing, judo, and combat sambo. When he came of age, he enlisted in the Soviet Army, spending 2 years in an elite special forces squad, followed by 4 years on a municipal police force after his discharge from the army. Like many Russian MMA artists, he received further training while serving in the Russian military and police force. A chance meeting with an American businessman in a Turkish bath convinced Zinoviev to become a professional fighter. This is funny here, because remember Isaac Cappy's Deadman Switch, after his Bracket and Jackets Epstein edition, you know, where he said that Epstein was the keystone. And it seems a lot of people think, and myself included, that that Deadman Switch showing a Turkish bat with girls that seem below the age of 8 was probably recorded either on the island or on the New Mexico Zorro Ranch. Probably the island, you know, because it's harder to traffic girls that young into New Mexico than the island. So it's less risky to do it in the island. So that's my opinion. I could be wrong, been wrong before. So Zinoviev finally gets his first sanctioned MMA fight, and it was at the inaugural War Extreme Fighting event in 1995 in Wilmington, North Carolina, where he defeated Marius Perry via cut stoppage to claim the organization's middleweight title, a title he will hold until 1998, where the company dissolved. Then he also fought in Japan, in Baldeturo, which was a variety of mixed martial arts, where he defeated Enson Inoue. I'm gonna link that fight on the comments in case you want to see how tough the bodyguard Igor really was. And it, you know, if this guy was terrified of speaking about Epstein, you gotta really congratulate those girls, those brave girls that came out and denounced him, because this guy is terrified even to this day. But I believe the problem is that he probably saw a lot of famous people as well. And while some of the girls are not willing to name famous people, or were only victimized by Epstein, this bodyguard saw a lot of people in 6 years. So I hope he talks someday, but it's not looking likely. So the bodyguard was defeated by Frank Shamrock at UFC 16. 22 seconds into the match, Shamrock took Zinoviev down with a powerful slam that knocked him out unconscious and broke his collarbone. That's what finished his fighting career. Since that time, he has worked as a personal trainer and bodyguard. In the 2015 interview, Igor was way more talkative. And he actually said that Epstein had so much money that he can pay everything off. But he was clear that he personally, if he caught Epstein with one of his daughters or something like that, he wouldn't go to the police. He would do something else much worse. So, you know, it's the Russian guy was afraid of his Epstein's financial power and influence, of course. And so the Russian goes into saying that he doesn't want to verify what he said on 2015, that in that interview he said that Epstein maintained relationships with various underage girls, and some became in love with him, and Epstein basically rotated the girls, two girls one weekend, two girls the other weekend, and so on and so on. Yet the bodyguard claims he's not afraid of repercussions, that he just wants people to leave the case alone. Look, the guy's dead, and freaking people, just leave him alone. So, you know, it's not looking like he's gonna talk ever. He has a 15-year-old son, Daniel, and a wife, Tatiana. They currently live in New Jersey, in a small town a few minutes from the ocean. His son is actually taking martial arts and swimming, just like his father, and he participated in the Junior Olympics. So, you know, sounds like he has a beautiful family, no reason to risk it. And, you know, you cannot blame him. That's just fine if he doesn't want to talk. And so we remain vigilant on what happens in this case. Nicola Sartaglione has been threatened by the officers at the correctional facility. They want him to stop bitching, stop talking, to shut up, or that he would suffer dire consequences. There would be a price to pay if he kept discussing Epstein's suicide. And so you see, this case is one of the most complex and confusing that you will encounter, because there's like four or five versions for every event that happened during the last month of Epstein being alive. Since he was arrested July 6th until he died August 10th, he was in prison around 34 days, and there's nothing clear about those 34 days. Just suppositions, versions, theories, things we cannot confirm. Let's just hope the victims get some justice now that they managed to testify today in court. I linked a video on the group. I will also probably link it on the Patreon description, so make sure you check those out. Tomorrow I'll bring you another episode, probably discussing the Black Book, Jean-Luc Brunel, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Rachel Chandler. So until tomorrow, my friends, take care.